Alright, hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianica, KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, and coming at you live here from the center of the universe. Jim West, how does it feel to be in the center of the universe?
Well, it feels okay, Jerry.
Yeah, you like it, huh? Okay, we're out there in the ethereal and everything, but you know, it really is, and I have to, I'm stealing that line. Actually, we were talking off mic. About Joseph Campbell.
Right.
Okay. And you might be familiar with Black Elk Speaks.
I think I might have read part of that.
Yeah. And famous, you know, Sioux.
Right, and right.
Wrote. And his favorite, highest point in South Dakota. So we're talking about topo maps and everything. You're familiar with Colorado. You know what the highest point in South Dakota is?
I do not.
It's Mount Harney. And it's in the Black Hills. And that's, you know, sacred ground for the Sioux Indians.
Okay.
And, you know, and that was, for him, the center of the world for Black Elk when you were on Mount Harney. But then after he's done, you know, he makes that observation, he says, of course, no matter where you are, this is the center of the universe. So, thank you, Black Elk. Thank you, Joseph Campbell. And I'm sitting here. This is Jerry on the Rabbit Hole Writer's Talk here visiting with Jim West. And we're going to be talking about topo maps, and not just maps themselves, but the stories behind the maps. Because you've had a few interesting characters come through your life here in the process of getting maps, topo maps, I take it, right?
I certainly have, right. I worked at the map store for about 9 years, and over that time, people would come in the map store for the usual reasons, mostly hikers, backpackers, hunters, geologists, and getting maps for their use. But every once in a while, someone would come into the map store and they'd have a very unusual reason why they wanted the map. And so I would be very interested in those, and we'd get to talking about what they were doing there and why they were doing it. Okay. Then I'd come home at the end of the day, and I'd say to my wife, "Hey, you wouldn't believe the person that came in the map store today." And I'd tell her the story, and she kept saying to me, "You need to put that down and write a book about it."
And you finally did.
And so I did.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that. Now, and you have worked at the map store itself, and that is the U.S. Geological Survey map, right?
Right.
Survey map store. And you said you're there for 9 years. You're also an instructor at the Colorado Mountain Club's Wilderness Trekking School. And so you taught map and compass, so you're familiar with all that.
Right. I learned about maps and map and compass use when I was in the Army. We did a lot of map work there, of course, part of your basic training. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I got my initial introduction. And then I've been an avid outdoorsman for a long time, and always used maps of one kind or another. So It's certainly not unfamiliar. And then when I got into the Mountain Club, I took the Wilderness Trekking School. And then not too long after that, I became first an assistant instructor and then an instructor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you've hiked quite a bit then. Colorado, Canyonlands out in Utah, Alaska too, you mentioned?
Yeah, we hiked in Alaska. We hiked in Denali, and we hiked around the southern part of Alaska near Seward, another hike near Anchorage. Mm-hmm. And we did a number of hikes in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And also in the Wrangell St. Elias Wilderness in Alaska as well.
And not to get too far, but this deals with hiking, I'm curious, because I've never hiked in Alaska, and I always have this dream, you know, and I remember the movie Into the Wild. how you would prepare for hiking, camping, etc. in Alaska, given the grizzly bears and everything, compared to, say, in the Canyonlands, Colorado?
It would be quite a bit different because there are no grizzlies in Canyonlands, but it would not be much different than hiking in, let's say, Glacier National Park, where there are lots of grizzly bears. Okay. You simply are very cautious about your cooking, when you're backpacking, that is, and make sure you reduce the amount of odors that you have when you're cooking so that you don't attract any bears. And then at night, you put your food in a bear container, a bear-proof container, mm-hmm. or perhaps you might hang it from a high branch in a tree. Sometimes we've done that. Mm-hmm. But in places where there are the most grizzlies, we tend to put it in a bear-proof container, put the food in a bear-proof container. And not just the food, but things like toothpaste and anything that has any kind of an odor, we put in a bear-proof container and then stash that away from the tent.
And the key is also not to put on any perfumes or deodorants, everything like that. That would
right. That smelling. Will also attract bears. One of the questions we had, or instructions, I should say, we had when we were in Yosemite a few weeks ago, was that we should always put our sunscreen in the bear-proof container. Of course, sunscreen you put all over your skin, your arms and your face and your legs and everything else. So you can't really take it off when you go camping. So we've never had a problem with that. But I've always kind of wondered whether the bears could smell sunscreen on us when we were camping.
I'm sure they could, you know, and along with mosquito repellent with the right. DEET and so on like that too. Yeah, it could be. It's real interesting, you know, when you start looking at that, the risk and the dangers, but also the thrill. What were the, on your own personal hikes? Because I want to get into the stories, you know, in particular, but you've done quite a bit of hiking. What were the more, exciting, challenging, memorable expeditions you've been on?
That's a good question. Probably one of the most memorable was when we hiked in the Himalayas. And we hiked to a total of about 16,000 feet. At 16,000 feet, I started to get a really bad cough and cold. And so I wasn't able to go on beyond that. But Anne was. She felt fine. She hiked up to over 20,000 feet to a place called Island Peak. And they used, it was all glacier travel. And so she had crampons on and used a rope to with the other people that were in the party. And she climbed to the top of that peak. So I was quite proud of her for that.
Yeah, and I remember reading Croc Hours, Into Thin Air.
Right.
And correct me on this, but the base camp is at 17,000 feet. And Camp 1 was at 20,000. And we think our highest peak in Colorado is approximately 14.
Right.
We're talking a lot higher, just get the base camp.
Yeah, the base camp, I think, is closer to 15 or 16, because we camped at 16 and we were higher than the base camp. We could look down on it, or look across at it, I should say. So it was probably around 16,000. It could have been 17. It was hard to see. Mm-hmm. But we could look across the valley and we could see off in the distance a smattering of tents at the foot of Mount Everest when we climbed up there.
So when you were working in the store, geological survey store, people come in, men, women,
right?
And most, I would assume, were like hunters or hikers. But I'm curious on that group there about skill levels and so forth, anywhere from rookies to veterans.
Most people are not too knowledgeable about hiking in the mountains. Even the people who live in Colorado, there's a lot of people who move to Colorado from other states. They might come here from, let's say, the Midwest or something like that, and they might not be familiar with the mountains, but they'll get some maps and they'll want to hike to the top of a 14er or even a lower mountain, and they don't know what they're getting into. And so we oftentimes have a discussion about that when we're talking about the maps. I ask them if they've been up and are, you know, what kind of preparations have they made and things like that. And so we have a little talk sometimes, and they're usually quite interested because they're anxious to learn and to be safe. So,
How long ago and how long? You were in the store for 9 years. How long ago was that? I'm just curious.
I started in 2004 and I went to 2013. That's when the map store closed.
Okay.
The map store was there for quite a bit of time before I ever got there. And the USGS had been selling topographic maps for years, a lot of them to geologists. Geologists would come in and buy 20, 30, 40 maps at a time because they were mapping out a certain place where they wanted to do some geological exploration. And then when I got there, the USGS had decided to contract the retail part of selling maps to a separate company. So they did that, that's when I started working there.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager was new. He had been there about 6 to 8 months, something like that. And he was very instrumental in changing the store and making it much more interesting. At first, we carried only USGS maps, but then we started carrying Bureau of Land Management maps, BLM maps, which were very interesting to hunters because they show who owns the land, whether it's private or public land.
Yeah.
We also started carrying a number of books. So we had a little bookstore in there as well. And then we started carrying things like stuffed animals and anything at all that you can think of that had that related to the outdoors in one way or the other, we started carrying. So we had a little gift shop, basically, in what was still called the USGS Map Store.
Yeah, and of course, I'm one of those Coloradans that you get your membership to REI.
Right.
And, you know, because I got a ton of maps, the Trails Illustrated maps, et cetera. Uh-huh. But curious on just your personal observation. This is, of course, anecdotal. I started hiking here in Colorado over 40 years ago. And when we did, you prepared, you learned.
Right.
Okay. But anymore, you get on the trail, I'm just seeing so many people there unprepared. In terms of footwear, not bringing, sunscreen, not even carrying water with them, and expecting, it's going to be like a walk in the park. Are you experienced that, or is it just my perception, or what?
No, it's absolutely true. I still hike a lot, but I also volunteer at Roxborough State Park here on the south side of Denver, and just this summer, I was there. It was one of the hot summer days, probably over 90 degrees. And one fellow walked in, and he was sweating profusely, and he was going to hike to the top of Carpenter Peak. Now, that's about a 3.5-mile hike, about 1,000 feet of elevation gain. Mm-hmm. And he had no water with him.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Do you have any water?" He said, No, I had some water before I left home. I'm pretty well hydrated." And that's as much as he knew. He wasn't interested in me telling him that he needed to carry a bottle of water with him. I think he's come down, but I'm not sure.
Hopefully, we haven't picked up a body or anything like that. A cadaver on the mountain, that sort of thing. I we both have many stories. I remember some years ago when I was hiking up Gray's Mountain, and it's about 1,000 feet, not even that, maybe 500 feet from the top, and there was a young man, in blue jeans and sneakers, and just like, oh my God, he was... And he didn't have anything with him. His buddy had left him on the trail. And he was from Florida. And had just come up. And they were going to hike this mountain. So, of course, I have my Gatorade and everything. Here, take this here, nutrients. And he was so determined. So I walked with him. Got him to the top. Walked with him all the way back down. Talked to him the whole time. He was fine. He made it. He was in relatively good shape. So that helped quite a bit there. And we got to the bottom. He introduced me to his friend. And his friend got an earful about abandoning him on the mountain because people perish and stuff like that. This is where you bring in the flight for life and everything like that. So I'm sure you've had some experiences like that as well.
As a matter of fact, Ann and I had an experience very similar to that. When we were hiking together, we were climbing a 14er. And we were fairly near the top, and we passed a woman with her two daughters. This story, by the way, is in the book. And we were on our way to the top, and the woman had on blue jeans, if I recall. They were not very well dressed for cold weather, and they had, I think, one or maybe two bottles of water between them, and their snacks was a cereal box, and they were sticking their hand in a cereal box and munching on some sort of cereal.
Fruit Loops.
So we got to the top. And I had a quick lunch, and we saw some black clouds were moving in pretty fast. So we finished lunch and hurried on down. And on our way down, we ran into them again. They were still climbing. At least the mother and one daughter were climbing. And we said, you might consider turning around. Those black clouds up there are going to hit pretty soon. You could easily be struck by lightning. It's very dangerous when these clouds come in like that. And the sky looked really threatening. So we said, "Where's your other daughter?" And we said... And she said, "She's a little bit down on the trail. You can see her down there." And we looked down the trail where it was switched back down, and there was a girl laying on the side of the trail because she was too tired to go on. She just lay down on the ground. And the mother insisted on keeping on going up because she thought she felt she was close to the summit. Well, she was, but it was still dangerous. So we told her to think twice about it, and then it started to snow. This was in July.
Mm-hmm.
So we hustled on down, and by the time we got to the girl on the trail, she was partly covered with snow. So we urged her to get up. We thought she might be getting hypothermic. told her mother is going to be coming down right behind us, but she wanted us to help her down the mountain. So we did. We took her down the mountain and talked to her, made sure she was, you know, cognizant of what was going on, and brought her down the mountain. And as soon as we got down the steep part into some trees, the snow let up and the sun came out, as it often does in Colorado with these summer storms. In the meantime, we had given her gloves, a hat, and an extra jacket so that she could keep warm. And when her mother came down, she was surprised to find that we had all that gear with us. And she said, "You always travel with all that extra gear?" We said, you bet we do, because this stuff happens.
Yeah.
It's really, it can happen very easily. And she was surprised. The girl was fine, but she might not have been if she had stayed there much longer.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more of that, you know, right here. We're in Clear Creek and Guanella Pass and then Mount Bjerkstad, because everyone thinks that's an easy 14er to bag. You know, you just head up from Denver, you know, you drive right up there. It's just, you know, a couple miles up the hill sort of thing. And on a day like today, which, you know, it's overcast, it's rainy, and it's probably snowing at the top.
Probably.
And we're going to get people probably trying to do it in flip-flops.
That's
like,
true.
Okay, you know, so pretend. But we want to talk about your work here. So you mentioned about, you know, you worked in the store and you come home and the answer is, okay, you need to put a book together. So you start into this adventure. Talk about that.
About the book?
Yeah.
Creating the
kind
book?
Of getting in there and then, yeah, let's get into specifics about the work itself. You know, maybe some of the war stories, if you will, in there.
Okay, well, I didn't write down any of the stories when I was working at the map store, but when it closed, I thought, you know, this might be a good idea. I think I'll do this. And I remembered most of the interesting stories that had occurred over the years. And so I just sat down and started typing. Now, I've been in writing. I've done a lot of writing over the years. I worked as a writer when I first started my career with the Mountain Bell and U.S. West, and then after that, after I left there, I became a technical writer, and for about 10 years, I worked as a technical writer. So I'm not a stranger to writing, and I didn't have too much trouble writing the stories themselves. So I put them together, and I talked to Anne and made sure that I didn't forget any, and she said, "What about this one?" "Oh, I forgot about that." So I put that one in and it as well, and when I had my first draft done, I gave it to her, because she's has such a background in writing and editing. So she took a look at it and she started editing it. And so that's when I started my first rewrite. And I had a number of rewrites after that and editing and so forth. And then I got involved with SEPA and ended up getting a professional editor for the final draft to go over it one more time. And I also talked to Veronica Yeager at Yellow Studios, and she did the cover design and helped me put the whole thing together and actually make a book out of it. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting process. I've never done that before. The writing part was not difficult, and I'd done that. But the editing, you know, really picked it up and brought some more life to it. And then, of course, the work by Veronica was great.
Yeah, you know, and I'm looking kind of at the table of contents. I am looking at the table of contents here. And I'm looking, you know, you've probably got at least 30 different little vignettes in here.
Yeah, we'll 25 them. Stories in there, I think, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they're not very long, maybe 2 to 4 or 5 pages.
That's
long,
right.
Like this, so not real heavy reading. But interesting stories then about some colorful people, I take it.
Absolutely.
Am I in it?
You're not in
it. You hadn't seen me on top of a mountain with a lightning rod up there, you know, like that. So probably not. But talk about the, what were... You know, because I'm going to, you know, get into a variety of these. But we'll say of all of them, you know, what were the top one or two you're going to like? You still scratch your head, shake your head about?
There's a number of them that are kind of interesting. There's one in there about a fellow who came in with and asked me for a map of the Arctic. Now, the USGS has maps of the Antarctic, of the continent of Antarctica, mm-hmm. But not the Arctic, the North Pole. It's just ice and water. And so there's really no maps up there. And I said, "Why do you need a map for that area?" He said, "I'm looking for a map that shows the hole that leads to the center of the Earth." Hmm. And I said, oh, really? And so he said, yes. And he said, as a matter of fact, I have a book that describes it. And he had a three-ring binder with a number of photographs or pictures in it, not photographs, but pictures that he had taken from the internet that showed what appeared to be a hole. And he said, there is a hole that goes to the center of the earth. I said, really, what's in there in the center of the earth? He said, the earth is actually hollow, he said. The center of the earth is populated by very tall people because there's not much gravity in there, so they grow very tall. And they're probably of Aztec descent, but I'm not sure, he thought. And he said, and there is a solar sun, a nuclear sun in the center of the earth that provides light 24 hours a day. And he said, and people lived in the center of the earth. And I said, that's very interesting. And I said, has anybody ever been in there that you know of? He said, absolutely. Admiral Byrd, who discovered the South Pole, found a large crack in the ice when he was on his journey to the South Pole. And he followed that crack down. And he got a glimpse of the center of the earth through this crack in the ice that led clear to the center of the earth. And I thought that was quite interesting. I said, well, how do you plan to get there? He said, I'm going to get on a Russian icebreaker, and that'll take me fairly close. He said, and the last part that they don't travel, I'll just get off the icebreaker and I'll just walk the rest of the way. I said, what are you going to do when you get to the hole? He said, I'm just going to jump in. I said, won't that be a problem? He said, no, I'll fall the first part because gravity will pull me down, but then I'll reach the center and then the gravity will reverse and I'll slow down until I get to the other side and I'll walk right out. And he was absolutely convinced that this could and would happen, and he was determined to go there and do it. Mm-hmm. So I told him, be sure to come back and tell me about it when you return.
And he's not been back till you.
I haven't seen him since.
Oh, my God. I won't editorialize here, but I think the amazing part is that you get someone, you know, whatever it is, okay, get into this mythology or whatever, this belief thing. And they're dead serious. And it's like, how do I respond to this? You know, essentially as a scientist, you know.
Yeah. When I run into someone like that, I usually just go along with them and say, fine, I'll get you whatever maps I can get for you, you know, and leave them alone. Mm-hmm. And wish them well. But most of the stories in there are not of people like that. Most of the stories are true stories of people that have had some interesting experiences. One fellow came in and he was looking for a particular lake in Alaska, a small lake. Now, Alaska has thousands, millions probably, of lakes, mm-hmm. small lakes. They're just all over the state. And he was looking for one particular lake. He didn't know the name of it, didn't know exactly where it was, but we put our heads together and he told me where he started from and which direction he flew and where he flew out of and so forth. And we finally were able to locate a map that he said had the lake on, and he found the lake. And I asked him why he was looking for that particular lake. And he said when he was in college, he was up there with a group of students and his professor. And the professor flew in with them and dropped all the students off and some of their gear. And the professor then said he was going back to get the rest of the gear and would return later on in the day. And they would be doing some studies of some of the animals that lived in Alaska. But the students stayed there with the other students, and the professor didn't return. So they waited, first one day, then 2 days, and they kept looking and waiting for this professor. He didn't know where he was. And after about 3 days, they heard the sound of an airplane, which landed then in the lake and taxied up to the dock where the students were. And the pilot came out and said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your professor was trying to come up here, and something happened, and his plane crashed, and he died. And so the students were all heartbroken, and they loaded up all the gear onto this plane and were brought back to their point of origin. And the fellow that was in the map store said he wanted to go back and visit that lake and get some closure, because the professor was very dear to them, and they really liked the guy. And sorry to that this had happened, and this guy, the student who is now an adult, a grown man, he wanted to go back and get some closure. So that's a kind of a story that I run into occasionally when I was at the map store.
Yeah, very powerful, personal one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There are a number like that in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not so much on a sense of adventure to go out there to explore, but to go back to that spot, that place,
mm-hmm.
that moment. Yeah, yeah. It, yeah, and I can imagine, because that starts triggering in my head, the whole wide range, because, you know, as a hiker, I simply want to hike to the top of a mountain, or I want to do this trail out in Canyonlands and just to explore it. But when you tell this story, and the first one too, you know, someone who believes that, you know, Jules Verne actually did create, not, you know, fiction, but a real story there about journey to the center of the earth, whatever, you know, what goes through people's minds when they do that? That's fascinating. Now, you have one there. It's called a bounty hunter. that kind of zeroed in on here. You know, and I'm thinking, what was the one in Dead or Alive? Remember back in the 60s there with right. Steve McQueen?
The bounty hunter was kind of interesting. A fella came in and sometimes you can tell when a person comes in that what they look like. You know, they might be... strong and long-limbed. They might look like a hiker. You might find a guy come in with a camouflage hat on. You might think that's probably a hunter. But this guy came in. I couldn't pin on him what he was. I didn't really know. And he looked just like a strong, kind of a tough guy. He had a short haircut, buzz cut kind of a thing, and stubble on his face, and had a gravelly voice. And I asked him, what he was looking for, and he said he wanted some maps of Arizona, particular maps next to the border. So we looked at an index of Arizona to find out which maps he wanted, and he pointed to the one out that he wanted, and so I got the map out for him, and he said, I asked him what he wanted to use the map for, and he says, well, you see these contour lines right here? I said, yes. He said, you know what those are? I said, yeah, they look like gullies or canyons to me, going from Mexico into the United States. He said, yes, that's exactly what they are. Do you know what they're used for? I said, no. I thought perhaps maybe people were coming over the border illegally. And he said, no, there might be some of that, but mostly they're used for smuggling. And I said, really? Well, what kind of work do you do? He said, I'm a bounty hunter. I said, how does that work? He said, well, I'll give you an example. Not too long ago, there was a woman who I arrested for smuggling drugs, and she was arrested and jailed and put in a jail in Greeley. She got out on bail, skipped bail, and went back to Mexico. So the officials over in Greeley asked me to try to find her and bring her back. So I went down to Buena Vista, Arizona, and hired a coyote to go find her at her hometown, which he did. He brought her back to the border. I picked her up and put her in my car. We drove back to Greeley. I gave her back to the authorities, and she's back in jail. And I said, it was quite an interesting story. And he said, yeah, it's a lot of fun. He says, it's quite an occupation. He said, would you like to join me sometime? I said, no, thanks.
I'm busy.
I don't think I'd like to do that, but I appreciate the work you're doing.
Well, it's when you mentioned Arizona, I'm not sure how familiar you are with Topo down there or anything. But I remember as a boy seeing this movie. It was about the Superstition Mountains.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, about the Spanish burying all this gold in there. And I'm still not sure why they call them Superstition Mountains. But I hiked it probably about 10 years ago. My nephew was there, and so we did a hike, and it didn't seem any different than any other mountain. But I don't know. I just mentioned that. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah. Did you find the Lost Dutchman
mine? No. That's what I'm looking for there, because then I could really be, you know. But so I guess you have people coming in asking questions like about that.
Oh, absolutely we do. Yeah. I lived in Arizona for a while. I lived in Phoenix, and I hiked Superstitions a little bit, but not too extensively. I was also my first position when I got back out of the Army was at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, which is right on the border. As a matter of fact, there is a Huachuca Mountain just south of the Army base. And if you go to the top of that mountain and look down the other side, you're looking into Mexico. So it's right on the edge. And I had been to, I'm a little bit familiar with the with the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you just did, you know, that sort of venture. And the other one comes to mind, too, something much closer to home in the San Luis Valley there about the points or the UFOs landing. You ever have people come in and ask about that, you know, that, you know, something
the
of that
nature. Area 51 or something like that?
No, that's more Nevada and, okay. You know, but here we're, you know, up in that high area. But just that type of people asking about, you know, like, okay, how do I find, rather than a very specific, you know, like with the bounty hunter, it was a very specific, and the same with the man, gentleman, you know, up in Alaska.
No, I don't recall that particularly, but I did have people come in looking for a particular mountain sometimes for various reasons. Mm-hmm. One fellow came in one time and he said, wanted to know if I had any maps of a particular area. And he pointed it out on a map. And I said, what you looking for? And he said, well, my house is sinking. I bought a new house and had it built on this property and it's slowly sinking into the ground. And I want to find out what's going on. He said, I've talked to the builder and they don't have any idea why it's sinking and they don't know. The nice thing about the maps, the USGS maps, is you can go back and find previous editions, mm-hmm. earlier versions of the same map.
Yeah.
And so we looked at the coordinates of where his map was, and I looked on the existing map, and there was nothing there that gave me any hint, and I went back further until I came up with a 1938 topographical map of that area. And right near where his house was the town of Derby. Derby, Colorado. There is no Derby, Colorado right now. It happens to be right next to another town called, what was then called Commerce Town. Well, Commerce Town expanded and Derby was absorbed by the town of Commerce Town, which then had enough of a population, so it was renamed Commerce City. So that's where his house was. It is in the Commerce City area. And in looking at that map, near Derby was an old gravel quarry, and it turns out that it was covered up with dirt, and the builder didn't know this and subdivided what was then a gravel quarry and built some houses on it. The unstable nature of the gravel was affecting this particular guy's house, and so he at least now knew what was going on. And he could said he could talk to the builder, maybe come to some sort of a resolution about what to do.
Yeah, fascinating there, too, because, yeah, not only in the maps iteration from back then,
right.
From, you know, say 80 years ago, approximately now, but, and how the land is, because it evolves, and, you know, there was a town there, and then it got
right.
You know, over, maybe a flood came through or something, too, that helped, you know, but we forget that in our history, and then you go to put a building on it or something, and the ground is not very stable under,
mm-hmm.
you know, that sort of thing there. Now, you've hiked all over. We talked about this a bit. And I was glancing through your book there, and I saw you've done, what, 38 of the 14ers? And,
I think so, about 38.
Mm-hmm. And you have, obviously, I would think people coming in like me just want to climb the 14ers. And so
sure.
What, some experiences on those, I guess. You know, the ones that are left for me, I've done 34 of them, and I look at what's left, you know, 20 left, and there might be four or five that I go, okay, yeah, I probably could do it, and all the rest is like, oh, heck no.
That's exactly where.
A lot of exposure.
That's exactly where we are. Some of the ones that we haven't done are a little beyond our level of interest right now.
Oh, I like the way you put that. I'm just not interested in that. You know, to look down at a 3,000-foot drop-off, you know, that sort of thing there. But those types, and by the way, I do want to remind our listening audience, I keep doing this. This is Jerry Fabianico, KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9, on the Rabbit Hole Writers Talk here, visiting with Jim Weston, reading, talking about his work, Topo, and the stories behind the maps, and just the human stories that go, you know, with people who come in and say, I need a map to wherever. Anywhere from something essentially found it like, why is my house sinking, to I got to nail this drug agent or drug you know, dealer.
Right.
Oh, wow, pretty amazing stuff there. But talk about the 14ers experience, too, and then the risk. We talked earlier about people going up on there that shouldn't be, but others that are prepared, perhaps. Any particular like that, you know, want to get out there and, you know, like you mentioned it, or like Ellingwood Ridge, I would never even think about doing anything like that. It's pretty brutal, I would think.
Ellingwood Ridge.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a time when three guys came into the map store and wanted to hike Mount Blanca, which is a 14er.
Yeah.
Little Bear, which is a 14er right next to it.
Okay.
And I think it's Ellingwood Peak.
Peak?
Ellingwood Point, it's called.
Point. Okay.
And which is, I think it's a 14er or close to it, just a little bit.
Are those north. In the San Juans?
They're in the San Juans, or okay. No, they're in the Sangres, I think, the southern end of the Sangre de Cristo Range.
Okay.
And these three guys were very fit. They're all young guys. They were in the Army, and they wanted to do some hiking, and they had come up with these three peaks that they thought they could knock off in one day. And so I got the maps out for them, and we had been up and climbed Mount Blanca, but Little Bear is a tough mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I described what it looked like and how to get from Blanca to Little Bear, and that there's a jagged ridge with a number of very pointed rock spires between the two mountains on this ridge that you have to climb around or over or something, and it's almost impossible. Some people do it, but it's not particularly easy. And they said what they wanted to do is to climb Blanca and then run over to and tap Ellingwood Point, as they called it, and then turn around and go the other way and climb to the top of Little Bear and then go down. Well, it's almost a sheer face from Little Bear down to the valley below. It's quite steep anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I said, a lot of people will climb Blanca and Ellingwood and then come down, spend the night in the valley, and then rope up and climb up the very steep face of Little Bear to get to the top. And as it turned out, there was another fellow standing who was listening to the conversation. He just joined in, and he explained to them how difficult it was and what you run into. And there's a place when you're climbing up Little Bear where you're in a couloir, a narrow gully where there's a lot of loose rocks. And it's called the bowling alley because these rocks come barreling down on you, and you better have a helmet on if you want to be safe. And they had no idea that any of this was up there. And the guy told him it would take you at least a day to do Blanca and Ellingwood and another day to do Little Bear. So don't plan to do it all in one day. It's pretty rough. So they listened to him because he had been up there and he had hiked the whole area. He knew what he was talking about. So here you had three guys who were strong and capable, young. They had the proper equipment and they were pretty much ready to go, but they just didn't know the terrain, didn't know what to expect. So that was an example of what I found in talking to them.
Yeah, so, eager, but, also really not aware of the challenges, difficulty, and the seriousness of that there. Because we're talking about earlier, people getting on the mountain unprepared, and just even something like Beardstap, which isn't all that tough to do, really. But then you get out there on Capitol and Pyramid, and it seems to me, I was reading something where the rate where they're doing it, search and rescue, bringing more people off, is increasing.
Right. That could be. I don't know the statistics, but I'm always surprised at the people who can climb these, who know what they're doing, mm-hmm. are very fit, very strong, very capable, very, very, very skilled.
Mm-hmm.
And they scamper up and down these things in no time at all. And I look at them and I think, how in the world did you do that? Mm-hmm. There's a recent story in the paper about a fellow that climbed El Capitan, the sheer face of El Capitan, which is several thousand feet, I think, what, 3,000 feet, if I'm not mistaken, in Yosemite National Park.
Yeah.
He did it without any protection, no ropes, nothing. He just free climbed the whole thing by himself without any help or anything. He did it in 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible. That's an unbelievable feat.
I wonder how much of that then, when you start putting this, because the social media, and we see, the races, who can climb all 54 14ers in the shortest amount of time.
Right. It becomes a contest for some competitive people.
Yeah. And then do it on bike or do it on skis in the winter and all this other stuff there. And you get to that point there. But I want to return back to some of these, because I noticed one of your little vignettes here is Lady Silver Hills. And that just struck me. I associate that with South Park. Is that correct?
Or? That's correct. There is a mountain in South Park called Silver Heels, Mount Silver Heels. And the story behind the naming of that mountain is quite interesting. There was a woman who, as the legend goes, is a woman stepped off the stage at a town called Buckskin Joe, which is near the town of Alma, at the base of Mount Silver Heels. It was a mining town back in the 1800s when she was there. she was known, or she went to work in a dance hall and became one of the fancy ladies for the dance hall, as they called them. And she was known because she had the heels, the high heels that she was wearing, were clad in pure silver. So she was called Silver Heels. And she would dance and sing for the patrons and dance with them. And the miners loved her. And everything went well until one day a couple of people came into town. And one of them got sick and died very shortly after he arrived into the town of Buckskin Joe. The next day, his buddy died. And it turned out they were both carrying smallpox. And as a result, smallpox swept, it was very contagious, and it swept through the town. And many of the miners who lived there died. And many of the other people who were there just left the town. It became almost a ghost town overnight. Lady Silverheels decided to stay there and attend to the sick miners. And she would bring them food and water and medicine, and she'd tend to them. And she'd work late into the night just tending to the miners that were there. After a while, the smallpox epidemic ran its course, and she was then staying with a woman that was referred to as Aunt Martha. The miners took up a collection because they wanted to repay her for her kindness. And when they went to go visit her, she was gone and didn't know where she was. And they asked Aunt Martha about her, and the woman said that the night before she had asked her to put up her hair and she put on one of her best gowns, and she left the cabin and was not seen since. And people suspect that what had happened is she got smallpox, but survived it, but was scarred from the smallpox disease, and she was too embarrassed to go back to work as a dancer, and so she went up into the mountain and died. The interesting thing is that the fellow who came in the store said that it was quite an interesting experience because he was up there, an interesting story, because he was up there hiking, and he was looking to summit Mount Silver Heels, but he lost his way and he couldn't find where the trail went. And so as he was trying to figure it out, look at his map and decide where it was, a woman came out of a small trail in the woods and asked him if she could help. And he said, "I was looking for Mount Silver Heels." And the woman said, "Well, you just need to go back the way you came until you come to an old log cabin. When you do come to that cabin, turn due west, and you'll be right on a trail that leads you to the summit." So he said, "Oh, thanks, okay." And so he turned around and walked away. And then he thought, "Gosh, I really didn't thank her properly. I should really express more gratitude." So he turned around, and she was gone. And he wondered where she went, because the trees weren't that thick and it didn't seem to be much of a place for her to go. There was a forest there, but he thought he should be able to see her because it was only a minute or two that had gone by. And he said he didn't know. And so he said to me, he wondered if that wasn't the ghost of Lady Silverheels, because as the legend goes, she's still there and she's still helping hikers hike up Mount Silverheels.
What a beautiful story. Yeah, you know, you hear stories like, and because, you know, with her profession, you know, businesswoman, dancer and everything, yet turn into Clara Barton sort of thing, you know, the nurse and everything, and then to go off by herself, and how much of that is, you know, reality, how much of that is fiction and truth, but nonetheless, this legend is there.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it's just gripping to think about that, and maybe Lady Silverheels is still there. So if you get lost over there, just outside of Alma, And it's very nice. The lady comes by, and I'm sure she's not hiking around in Silver Hills, but it probably has hiking boots on, et cetera, you know, the appropriate garb. But her spirit is still there. That's a powerful one there, too. So this is great stuff. We could just go on and on here about the various stories. Do you think about, you know, doing another work like this in some other way? Maybe continue with different stories or, you know, maybe something at least in this genre?
I have given a little bit of thought to it. I don't have any other. I have a few stories that I could add to this list that I've put together, but not enough to make another book. But I did serve in Vietnam for a year, and I know there are a lot of books about Vietnam and about the battles that took place, the people that were there and the dangers that were there. But nobody's ever written about some of the funny things that happened over there and some of the unusual and not so dangerous incidents that happened just because people are people.
Yeah.
I thought maybe I might, I don't know if I have enough of them to make a book, but there are certainly some. I have a few interesting stories about when I was there.
Well, I certainly encourage you, because just sitting here, when you're telling that story of Lady Silverhills, on top of the other ones you told, you're a powerful storyteller. You have a good voice for it, but you tell the story in a succinct way, and you do. When you were talking about Lady Silverhills, I was so captured by that power there that I started choking up there at the end. And I'm thinking, you know, whether it's like the lighter side of Vietnam, we'll put it that way, or the myths and legends of stories like Lady Silverhills in Colorado and around, to pull those out, because, you know, it leaves you. I used to work over at Mary Jane, and if you're familiar with that whole thing, you know that why Mary Jane is called Mary Jane.
Oh, I don't know.
She was a very successful businesswoman over there in the late 19th century. We'll leave it at that. And her boyfriend owned the claim there. And so her name was Mary Jane. So he called it the Mary Jane Claim. Well, then when Winter Park expanded 50 years ago over to what is now Mary Jane Ski Area, they simply adopted that name. And there's this rich history of Mary Jane there. You know, so, you know, she didn't disappear into the woods, you know, I don't think, like Lady Silverhills. But rich stuff like that, because it's part of our history, it's part of our culture. And those of us that live in Colorado, especially you live up here in the mountains, you hike the mountains, do whatever, it's not just a mountain. There's human stories behind it. The miners that were there, the explorers. Oh, my God. What's his name? The cannibal. You know, that
Alfred Packer.
Alfred Packer.
Alfred Packer, yeah.
You know, and he ate all the Democrats or something like that in Ruffino County. But there's so many like that. I think maybe I can't tell you what to do, but I think you'd be really good at that, Jim. It really would be.
Well,
so
thank
something
you.
To think about that. Okay, but if people want to get a copy of this particular work, Topo and the stories behind it, how might they do it?
The best place would be Amazon, I think. If you go to Amazon to get the book, be sure you enter not just the word Topo, but the entire story or title of the book, which is Topo, The Stories Behind the Maps.
Okay.
And then you can also look at my website, topothebook.com,
okay,
and order from there.
Yeah.
You know it connects to Amazon, but that's fine.
Yeah, either way. Like this here, because it's human interest stuff. And what I love about also works like this, you set it on your coffee table, you know, and you just want to deprogram a little bit, and you just want to sit there and sip a cup of tea or coffee or something just to wind down, or, you know, whatever. It could be in the afternoon, evening. You get up, and it's light reading, and it's delightful. It's also insightful, and sometimes a little hair-raising on occasion, you know. But it's like, wow, uh-huh. You know, it just takes you into that other universe, that other realm that we just hear about, you know, and then you step right into it, you know. So,
right.
Yeah, congratulations on that. So, all right, we'll look forward to the next rendition of Topo, the stories, you know, Vietnam, the lighter side, myth and legends, whatever, but, you know, you're on a journey.
Okay.
You're a great storyteller. So.
Thank you.
All right. All right, everyone. Hey, this is Jerry Fabianca on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. Been visiting here with Jim West and talking about his work, Topo, the stories behind the maps. And, pretty interesting stories here we have in Colorado around the Western for those of us who love the mountains and love people, too. All right? We'll be back. All right? Take care now. Bye.